Welcome to the ADHD Alchemy Podcast, where women with ADHD finally feel seen, understood, and unapologetically themselves. If you have ever felt like you're too much and not enough all at the same time, you're in the right place because that's the alchemy, learning how both come together to make something priceless. I'm Jessica Covington, holistic ADHD coach and fellow fancy brain, and I'm really glad you're here. Let's get into it. Welcome to ADHD Alchemy. It's more than a podcast. It's also my signature coaching program at Fitology. It's perfect for bright, sensitive women who are tired of feeling scattered and chaotic and ready to feel calm, clear, and finally in control. Inside the program, whether it's group or private, we tone down the harsh inner critic, break old patterns of procrastination and self-sabotage, and start redefining ADHD on your own terms. So in just a few weeks, you'll find yourself grounded, confident, and leading your life with intention by learning to work with your fancy brain instead of against it. This is where your too much becomes your magic and where real lasting change starts on day one. If that speaks to you, please find more at fitology.com. That link, of course, will be in the show notes. And today we have with us Josie Jarvis, a licensed occupational therapist, soul rewilding coach, and facilitator of trauma-informed creative recovery spaces. Her work is at the intersection of ADHD, creativity, nervous system regulation, and recovery from performance-based and institutional conditioning. As an OT, she spent over a decade working in systems like healthcare, education, and academia, where she saw firsthand how ADHD traits are often misunderstood, suppressed, or mislabeled as noncompliance, burnout, or failure to cope. She's also navigated firsthand the internal cost of masking, overfunctioning, and performing competence at the expense of well-being. So Josie, I'm so glad you're with us today to share all of these stories.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I am so excited to be here. And I think in a way, since this is an HD space to celebrate, I completed actually my clinical doctorate in 2023, which kind of was like a badge, because kind of growing up as I initially was born in Wyoming and I lived in various parts of Kansas. So even though I live in the Pacific Northwest now, there was something about being a neurodivergent misfit rural woman that really wanted to prove that we can succeed at academic tasks and things like that. So I'll share that because I didn't realize once I got to share to an occupational therapy assistant school and they're like, whoa, you have ADHD and you got that? I think a lot of people in academia are neurodivergent, whether they know it or not, but it is so important that we celebrate each other and our accomplishments wherever they show up, because of what you mentioned before, we learn in our culture to be so ashamed of ourselves, because I think as women too, it's not just that we don't fit in with social norms, we often defy gender expectations as well.
That's true. Yeah, great point. So, like many of us, your journey to ADHD began with a diagnosis of mood disorders. Could you share a little bit about your struggle to find and accept your thinking style?
Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, that is so true. And it, like, that diagnosis, it came at such an unfortunate time. I had, it happened on the very day that it just so happens I became an occupational therapist, because I grew up with my cousin who was diagnosed from a young age with a rare chromosomal disorder called Rett syndrome, which was once thought to be on the autistic spectrum disorder. But I think that I suspect that they're not categorizing it yet, because, you know, I think a lot of neurodivergents with the brain, it's more, it's not necessarily at that chromosomal level that I don't think that they're still seeing that linkage. And Rett syndrome tends to exclusively affect, you know, biological females, because it affects that X chromosome. So I got to go to birth to three series therapy with her, and it looked like McDonald's play place. It looked so fun. And I think I was also just finally around other neurodivergent kids. So I just felt so excited. It was like a place that I felt accepted, and I just loved my cousins so much. So from age 10, I decided I wanted to, I called it an occupational physical therapist at the time because I didn't know that they were separate. And I held that inside, and that stuck with me for quite a bit, which what's great for me about occupational therapy is that we help people with injury, illness, disability adapt to daily life challenges. And I think, in a way, going with my cousin to her therapy services, I think there was a part of me at the time that was actually kind of jealous. Because she oftentimes, we talk about this in the therapy community, that when you have a physical disability, there's a lot less like medical gaslighting about it, right? Like there's a lot more obvious understanding of how a physical impairment could disrupt your daily life and where you might need support and unique space to process things. Particularly as now women and presumably our middle age with ADHD, that also meant that at when we were younger, number one, they might not have had the diagnosis ADHD, but then number two, they didn't know about it for women. I know when I first started my doctorate degree, even one of the foremost experts in adolescent executive functioning had a personal belief that girls couldn't have ADHD. That was like, that helped me give myself some grace that I was like, wow, if absolute leaders in the field in the 2020s believe that girls can't have ADHD, I guess that gave me some grace with my parents and with my support system. So it didn't happen that I totally broke down in my early 20s where in retrospect, sorry, this is just bringing up the memories of it. So what first happened is my father got diagnosed with adult ADHD. And so that's when my mom thought, well, you and Josie have a lot of similar traits. So she wanted me to see the same psychiatrist that my dad had seen, which in retrospect isn't the best practice. It's good to kind of separate things because you want somebody that, especially when it's like intimate psychological details, it's kind of good to have a separate thing. So I definitely don't recommend going to see the same exact psychiatric professionals that work with your parents and whatnot. But that was the first time I got diagnosed with ADHD. And man, she gave me the diagnosis within like 5 minutes.
No kidding.
And I kind of think, I won't say her name, she's since retired, but I think it was kind of like a little bit of like a pill farm thing. Like I think a lot of people brought like in the suburbs, oh, my kid has trouble with this, and then come in. And I definitely am really passionate now about advocating for both my clients and I guess on this platform too, that if you suspect that there could be a neurodivergence or potentially, a mood disorder or something, I highly recommend building as much of a village as possible. Now that we have wonderful ADHD coaches such as yourself, and we have more neurodivergent friendly psychotherapists and counselors, if you do want to work with somebody for medication, I just recommend having a village around you because it's so important when you're trying to weed out what kinds of diagnoses or symptoms could be coming in the weeds. It really takes somebody knowing you quite intimately. From what I understand, so I got misdiagnosed with bipolar. It happened to be on the day my cousin I just told you about died. And they had me on such high doses of Ritalin and Concerta that I had come to her being concerned that I was having hypomanias, which can be a side effect of stimulant medication. And when I had expressed that, and at the same time, I was also kind of coping with somebody who was like stalking and harassing me on campus. And so I had actually a lot of reasons for having a more exaggerated mood
I'll
that
say.
time.
What a
Plus, I was
convergence.
under, I just happen to be somebody too that stimulant medication hasn't always put me in the most effective zone. So I don't tend to use medication personally. But because of that experience, I thought that I had bipolar. First, she put bipolar one, but then it shifted to bipolar two. And I've heard that from women in my generation in particular, I was born in 1989, about to turn 37. A lot of women from my generation, this is kind of a common experience. And maybe you can speak from your perspective too, if you've heard about this affecting others. The because a lot of people thought that ADHD can affect girls when we show up with a lot of bigness or kind of, some of the ways I've learned now that ADHD, like we tend to grieve a little bit differently. We have a hard time with transitions. We have unique experiences with friends. We're, regarded sometimes as like too much, right, by our, people around us. And so that can lead to, if you repress your emotions, right, they come out so big. So it's very common. And this is just also kind of how our mental health infrastructure from its root has been quite unfriendly to women who express emotionally. And so I think all this context really matters because of how painful that experience was when I thought I was bipolar. And I, if anybody listening here does identify with having bipolar or has a loved one with bipolar, I feel that so many people that I've met with bipolar are some of the most deeply gifted people I've ever gotten to bear witness to, and have so many. I know Robin Williams had bipolar. Bipolar people are incredible. So by no means, I don't want to perpetuate any stigma towards that. But what I imagine, if you do have bipolar, you might identify with. What's so unhelpful about it is it teaches you to kind of almost have an adversarial relationship with your emotions, because I thought that my emotions were always going to be not appropriate or fit. Like I thought they were going to be artificially exaggerated, repressed, and it really disrupted my ability to accept them with compassion and grace and like understanding. I was sort of at war with them. And I would always challenge everything that I thought because I was so prepared to be embarrassed for my, like, it gave me the exact opposite of what I think any therapist would actually say. With your emotions, you're usually supposed to sit calmly, try to identify it, give yourself sympathy and compassion, let it kind of move through you. And at the time, especially from the medical model, that's not quite what I received. So it took me a while to actually circle back and accept that I truly do have ADHD. I think I had to get diagnosed two more times after that. And I love that you're centering working through shame, because I think that's a lot of what kept me from going back in and thinking of like, okay, well, if I have ADHD, it's time for me to kind of take some responsibility for this.
And once you did come to understand and accept ADHD as a part of your life, how did that change the way that you think about yourself and the way that you function in everyday life?
And what's so funny, even though, so I just was telling you guys a story about my early 20s, and what was kind of awful about that is I was on the wrong medications for almost like 6 or 7 years. Like early in your early 20s, like that's not when you want to be on like mood stabilizing medication that causes weight gain and like numbs out all your emotions. So it really was a horrible experience getting misdiagnosed with bipolar. I also kind of, I don't know if this might affect other people too. I also was put on medication quite early in my life from struggles of managing my menstrual cycle, because I think a lot of ADHD women, we actually struggle with time awareness and those sort of things. So I also happened to be on continuous birth control for quite a bit of my adolescence and young adulthood as well. And what I found is that didn't give me an opportunity to actually learn how to work with and like manage my emotions, because if you like suppress them, you don't get to know what they are. So going into my late 20s and 30s, I actually went off like all medications to give. I know you focus on physical health too, and from what I understand from a lot of the research coming out, there are so many nuances around women with ADHD and our menstrual cycle. Like it totally
Absolutely.
changes. Do you want to speak a little bit to that?
I would love to. I want to stay focused on your story, but
Yeah.
it's absolutely
Yeah. Okay.
true
We
that
can rant. Yeah.
reproductive hormones and neurotransmitters have a really intricate relationship, and the slightest tip off of one or the other affects both.
So I think that was a big thing for me to also even go off birth control first, because first you
Yeah.
need to know what something is before you can know how you want your relationship to it to be. Healing my relationship with my emotions, that's taken a lot. I've really have gotten a lot out of the How to ADHD YouTube channel and community. I think it's Jessica McCabe, her book, and then the Dirty Laundry book by the
Yes.
ADHD love couple. When I really committed to owning, like, okay, I have ADHD, I need to learn this, I listened to that book on audiobook, I listened to the Dirty Laundry one, and I started working with an ADHD coach as well. She happened to be a social worker, but also had a lot of commonalities. So I found somebody that have a lot of commonalities with, which I think can be quite important because, right, there's a lot of different variety for us as women with ADHD. Some of us were stigmatized so thoroughly in our early educational experience, you might not have the high achiever strain. I definitely have the high achiever strain, and that's often a very different experience than one where you maybe didn't have an environment that supported you adequately, and that stigma can be quite deeper if you're not getting conventional accomplishments, or maybe you were penalized a little bit harsher earlier in your life. But that shame work is so important to get to a place of acceptance, because we can't start adjusting how something is featured in your life without first accepting it.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, that's a great one to underline. You can't start to change it until you accept and understand it. Absolutely.
With compassion. So I want to share gratitude to you, because I think I would guess, and sorry if I'm wrong, but you might more identify with Gen X and I'm a millennial. Is that accurate
That's
to
right.
say?
Yes, 1970.
Right. But we were just before we got into this, we were talking about, it was World Women's Day yesterday, and I was, reflecting about all of those women that stood up together against the injustices that they were experiencing in the turn of the century here in the United States, and a lot of them were rural women. Jessica got to share with me that she also grew up in, was it North Carolina?
That's right.
And then Georgia. So oftentimes rural women, we get underestimated and we have this quiet power, and one of that is like organizing. My profession, it started during the arts and crafts movement, and I like to say before women could vote, they found a way to change the Constitution and take alcohol away from alcoholics. So never underestimate rural women, but I imagine a lot of them were likely neurodivergent, not fitting in, thinking outside the box, finding pathways outside of less traveled by. But I say this just to say I'm really grateful to all the women that are finding out that they're neurodivergent later in life. I
Yes.
secretly think my mom might have it and that she hasn't maybe accepted it yet. It does mean a lot to me to have role models and have other trailblazers that are willing to have these conversations and speak up. This is how we actually break down those like glass ceilings for the girls coming behind us. We're the leading wave. So it's really important, not just for yourself and your self-acceptance, but to know that there are thousands of young neurodivergent girls that really need role models that show them compassion and grace and understanding for what they're going through. It's a burden, but it's also a privilege and opportunity that we have to kind of get to steer the ship of how, now that we know women have ADHD and neurodivergence, what is that going to look like? What do we want to create together to support them, knowing that the systems totally fail is maybe a cool creative challenge of what we get to create together and innovate. I believe I became the OT that I needed. It was a
Yes.
very expensive way to do it,
But you did.
but it's helping to move that needle, and just the littlest amount can go such a long way. So I'm really proud of you too for creating this platform and the ripple effect that can come.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. That ripple effect is really, really important to me because the whole goal, what I really want to do, whether it's through coaching or podcasting or whatever, is to change the global conversation about ADHD specifically, but neurodivergence in general. Let's just change the way we think about it, talk about it, approach it, and everything. So yeah, thank you for those kind words.
Learning how to accommodate each other is so important. The true violence, I guess, for me in navigating the misdiagnosis with bipolar, which later I'll mention. Like, I got to have a conversation with this with a clinical psychologist. She lived with low vision, and I think she mentioned having some neurodivergence herself, but she happened to specialize in bipolar. And I've had so many specialists in bipolar say what was improper about my diagnosis. But she talked a lot about how sometimes we internalize these diagnoses as if they're like these fixed, written in stone tablet things. And she, from a clinical psychologist perspective, mentioned that it is actually very common to have diagnosis evolve and change, even just responding to treatment. Like, there's all sorts of things that can actually, you might not have the more adverse symptoms of once you kind of have routines and rituals that kind of manage some of the symptoms. They can evolve and disappear over a lifetime. And often, functionally, they're what our mental health professionals, they have to put them on a form so that we get some insurance reimbursement for it. So very often it is a bureaucratic thing than this like prophecy from on high. And it is a really important thing that we play an active role as the client and receiver of services, letting this be something that you learn as much as about as possible and take, and learn who you are as a person. That's what I like about my field of occupational therapy is it's not about your diagnosis, but it's at how do we optimize your daily life and take into account the entirety of who you are, which also includes the stories you tell about yourself. I have another, I'm very multi-passionate as an ADHD trait, in figuring out how to put boundaries around things. So I also had like a spiritual podcast that looked at spiritual multiplicity and things like that, and looking at so many of the gifts of ADHD that don't fit in with the medical model. One of the ways that I think we can take the shame off them is to celebrate the parts of ourselves and our personalities that just have that sparkle too. It's so important not to become like a professional patient and just learn all the downsides of things. We do that as clinicians so that insurance pay as much as possible, but then we can internalize this stigma that somehow we're pathological or that's part of ableism and how we internalize it. So it's so important to learn your traits and your endearing things and to find ways to celebrate and accept those, maybe even especially because I think it's a good thing to not fit into today's society. Like, so much is not going well in the collective that maybe it's a compliment that we've had trouble fitting in.
And the way I tend to think about it is that everything that a clinician might write down on a form for insurance purposes, everything perceived as challenge, a weakness, whatever you want to call it, has a flip side. If you think about impulsivity, one of the key most common factors in ADHD, you flip that over, impulsivity really becomes spontaneity and creativity and lightheartedness and humor
Bravery.
and divergent thinking and yes, bravery, absolutely.
Yeah,
So
that
there's
courage. That's why I think I was, that's why I'm quite certain that a lot of these suffragettes and women standing up for workers' rights, that takes an impulse and it takes like a big belief. One of the things I love about my flavor of ADHD, and I know a lot of with autism have this as well, is justice sensitivity.
Absolutely. For sure. So I don't want to let the conversation get too far away without
Oh, what?
mentioning all of these interests of yours, folk art and ancient practices and creativity and so on. And you described them before we got on the air, you described them in a way that I've never heard before. So I would love for you to just say a little bit more about the different ways that you bring your interests together and what that means to you.
Oh, thank you so much for that. We were talking a little bit about what has been my biggest challenge lately, and I've mentioned that it's been learning what to let go of. And I think this is a hard thing, especially for those of us entering perimenopause and menopause, where our ability to hyper focus and work miracles through everything, it might just kind of temper a little bit. And so I've had to put a little bit on seasonal hiatus. I had a community which is still present. So if you do want to take in some of the resources that are in the Rewilding the Mythic Self School community, there I was working on creating an Adaptive Artist Way series, which I just need to put a bit more intention into it because I really want to be respectful of Julia Cameron's copyright. I had her exercises, which can be a past a paywall, but this is like a free community. So again, this is that justice sensitivity in action that can come through. And so I'm just realizing I have so much on my plate. Clinically, I work full time as a home health occupational therapist, and then I do my own field research that I've self-funded because it doesn't really fit into traditional academic boxes. But a lot of what I've been personally experimenting with is trying to go back to the roots of the occupational therapy field and get in touch with my own ancestral line as well, in that I imagine others with neurodivergence might connect with this. We tend to, right, have this sense of feeling a little bit alien, not fully fitting in. I didn't fully fit in my small town because my parents were the only ones in the town that didn't go to church, and so they were very skeptical about that. I went to church, but it was just we were kind of the outsiders a little bit. And from that, and then so like with my ADHD, I also have some giftedness. I have like hyperlexia, which I think comes from some nonverbal learning disability, which is where it has some similarities with autism, except it's the inability to read body language. So we're not able to mask as well as autistics, actually, which can lead to being made fun of more in a way. But I've noticed in my family line, and I suspect this may be common in other family systems, is there can be pressure for women, no matter what diagnosis, to not shine like too brightly. Like you gotta be like, you know what I'm, yeah. So that can create this sense of, if I don't belong in my community, if I am in full expression of who I am I gonna risk being exiled from my family? Women before that did not fit the box. They might have got diagnosed with hysteria. They might have been actually sent to asylums and commissioned. Like there's deep kind of witch wound stuff that can come up for us. And so, getting connected to ancestral and folk art work, which is where OT started, was the arts and crafts. Nobody had any diagnosis, but they were given creative outlets, which, if you can create from your emotional waves and experiences, there's a magic to that with the alchemy, right? ADHD alchemy, creativity, expression, having actual creative outlets for our energy and for our hyper focus and our special interest when that comes out, to relate to that with less stigma and as something that you can celebrate that helps move you towards maybe even your soul alignment and life purpose. But I knew in my line that I had ancestors that had done, like, so the story for me was that during COVID-19, I kind of had a breakdown because I was working on the ground floors of our hospital systems. And my mom has a large family. She's the oldest of seven. And I found in our group chats, we had every flavor of extreme belief system. We had anti-vax, we had vegan anti-vax, we had MAGA, we had MSNBC. We had everybody that was so certain about what was going on, but nobody was on the same page. But what I knew for sure is nobody wanted to know from me or my uncle that was a firefighter what was actually happening on the ground. And so I felt really powerful, but I also felt very alone. But I knew that my great grandaunt Vignes, who was a field medic on horseback in the 1850s, I knew that she kind of knew what I was going through. And I made this vow and I rescinded attachment to any belief system that I could not be connected to my ancestors here and now. And I say that because I come from my dad's side lineage is from settlement in the Tippecanoe Territory, Utah, with the Latter-day Saints. And they specifically have a belief system that you can't really connect to your ancestors until after you've crossed over. And that just, belief system doesn't align with me personally. But after I was able to make that proclamation, I could just feel her love and support around me. And I could feel my grandmother's encouragement. And my great aunt Kate, who was this powerhouse that built this museum in Temple Square in Utah, that's like marble and has all the artifacts of the people that settled. And I just had this feeling like I'm not too much for them. And they accept me. So ancestral work in broadening what spirituality can look like for you as a neurodivergent and taking some ownership of that. That has been actually quite instrumental for my healing and therapeutic journey because we have to start with that safety and that belonging. And it's hard for our nervous system to feel safe if you feel at a fundamental level you don't belong in the universe. So I had to take it to that spiritual level. Maybe not everyone does, but for me, that's been key. And that's what I wanted to kind of support others with too, in a way that maybe felt even a little bit secular to a certain degree and not non-hierarchical spirituality exploring there. So that's kind of what happens on Rewilding the Mythic Self.
I love it. Man, I feel like we could
I
extend
know
this
I've
into
gone way
hours,
beyond what you
but
have. I'm pretty expansive. So yes,
there's
we
so
can do
much
another
more.
one.
Yes, maybe we'll do a second. There is so much more I want to ask you about. But now that we need to wrap up, I want to ask if you had a billboard to be able to broadcast a message to the entire world about differently wired minds, what would your billboard say or look like?
Well, what just initially came to my mind was just better together, right?
Oh,
We
yeah.
need diversity. We need brains that think differently because we keep reproducing the same systemic problems. It's at scale internationally. We need to start thinking differently. We need to allow for diversity to inform how our workspaces. One of the things that I'm trying to help revive in the occupational therapy community is the initial occupational therapists were critiquing the formats of the Industrial Revolution, what that was happening, how that was affecting the mental and physical health of going from working in your farm, working on your homestead. Part of why we probably didn't have ADHD and autistic diagnoses before, like until we've hyper standardized education and hyper standardized our work environments, is if you're on a homestead, if you have an ADHD, you have an asset. You're like, oh,
Yes.
gotta get the eggs, gotta get this. I'm in nature, I'm in the, like, it was just
Yeah.
naturally a regulating environment. And the generation that went from working on the farms to working in these industrial slum things, they just saw viscerally how depleted their lifestyles became because of that. And so I think as some of our institutional frameworks start to break down, if we can give ourselves permission to share power, share responsibility, and allow some of the creative ones to also play a role in imagining what does health affirming work look like? How can we support each other to even create entrepreneurial things? How do we make space for everyone? View yourself as an ADHD woman as a potential visionary. What I've had to come to expect, people literally do not think the way we do. They don't understand it. That's why it's so unnerving. Most of us, until you know you're neurodivergent, you think, well, everybody j thinks and looks at things the same way. No, not true. And it could be that we have some medicine that the collective needs to see things from a different perspective, because what we're doing right now, it's not working for basically anyone.
Beautiful. Yeah, I think that's not just a possibility, but a certainty for sure.
Indeed. I think that's why a lot of people spiritually, I used to try to keep my clinical and spiritual stuff separate, and it just integrates because we bring that all with us wherever we go. But a lot of people spiritually feel that this neurodivergent wave that we have is to help us transform systems on the collective. You can see that in the school systems, because I used to work in school-based OT, and failing to be properly civilized or like not integrating well, it does force the whole system to change. And all of a sudden, just accommodating one student with autism or ADHD can transform the experience from the entire classroom. So neurodivergent, neuroaffirming approaches to things are just human affirming approaches to things. They create conditions where human rights can thrive. Everybody benefits from our accommodations. So when we advocate for ourselves, we're actually advocating for kind of all of humanity. And to create structures that, like, the reason we have curve cuts is because there was a movement to help make things more inclusive to people with wheelchairs. We've just now progressed where we, as women with ADHD, are such an incredible opportunity for the disability rights movement continuum because, man, we have voices and we have creative ideas. Like it or not, the fact that we're annoying means that we're kind of listened to. And there are so many people. I love that this can come full circle, that like my dream was to have a world where me and my cousin Libby could have grown old together. And I'm committed to try to build out infrastructure and awareness for younger adults with disabilities to have access to supports, because those resources, they just drop off at age 21. We're going to have to get scrappy together, especially as women, because we're the glue that holds everything together when all the systems fall apart. So if we can empower each other, accept each other, man, I'm so excited about what we're going to build together.
Absolutely. So speaking of that, I know that people are going to want to learn more about you and your work. Where can they connect with you?
Definitely. So I have two spaces. One that's for informal and rewilding, which I recommend having your space for yourself. That's part of being an institutional people pleaser. Having own space where you're allowed to be unmasked and unfurled and without any responsibility towards anybody except yourself. And I recommend having that, carving that, even if it's just 5 minutes a day. So that's Josephine Patricia, which is my first and middle name, full names. There, I have a podcast where I talk to others who are interested in non-traditional spiritual modalities and ways of looking through that lens on neurodivergence to help diffuse some shame around it. And then I have kind of some introductory guides of how to get into ancestry work there. And that's through Rewilding the Mythic Self, Josephine Patricia. And for those who like to kind of be a little bit nerdy about the therapy world and speaking across differences and thinking interdisciplinarily, there I am very mindful of my professional credentials and making sure I fact checked, cross my D's and dot my I's, the Evolve Living podcast and Josie Jarvis OT Substack. There I do a lot of critiques of the medical model, and I host discussion with other clinicians, scholars, and community members on how we can come together and envision what this next phase of the disability rights movement can look like together.
Beautiful. Josie, thank you again so much for being here and for sharing so transparently. I just know stories like yours are helping other women to see and feel in a really visceral way that they're not alone in this. And the way you've been able to synthesize your interests and your experience is so inspiring. So Thank you
Thank
again
you
for
so
being
much
here.
for this opportunity and sisterhood, and excited to see the growth of your work and the impact. It really, for those listening, I've worked with two ADHD coaches so far, and it's been really instrumental to have that co-regulation and somebody who can look at a situation you're going through and reflect back your strengths. Because sometimes it's hard where there's that shadow side of the things that get stigmatized of where our gifts and our strengths are. And sometimes it really does take somebody who can see that before we can see it, or that can kind of hold that space. Because no matter how old we are, like, we still need the wisdom of our elders, of our growth things, and our peers. It's so hard for us to sometimes find supportive reciprocal friendships. And so having a coach that you know is there for you, and that you can have some agency in what you're working on with, that has fully transformed where I'm at with my ADHD. So I definitely recommend, if you resonate with Jessica, just take that leap. Get a feel for what it's like. Follow this. Give yourself, right, that support that maybe, just wasn't available when you were a kid. You can still get that at any time, and we're worthy of that. So please, make sure that you're prioritizing your mental and physical health. And, every time that you invest in yourself, especially if you have children, they're going to notice that. And they're going to go further faster because they see from maybe their mom that they have permission. Whenever we have that ripple, that's the most important ripple to create. So please do not deny yourself from that. Check out what Jessica is offering.
Oh, thank you so much. And it's true, better together. Thanks again,
Indeed.
Josie.
Thank you so much.
Here is today's ADHD Alchemy Lab Kit, three ideas from this episode that you can try in your own life. Number one, rewrite an old story. Many of us carry old labels from earlier diagnoses or misunderstandings, or even just things we heard over and over again as we grew up. To counteract that, try this. Write down one phrase that you have believed about yourself for years. Things like, I'm too emotional, I can't follow through, I'm unreliable, I'm messy or lazy. And know that a belief is only a thought that's been practiced over and over again. If we change the thoughts, we change the belief. So ask yourself about that phrase that you wrote down. What ADHD trait might actually be underneath this story? We're referring here to the mirror traits that Josie and I talked about. So your belief, could it stem from emotional intensity or creative thinking, deep sensitivity or justice sensitivity, or nonlinear focus or something else? And see what changes when the story moves from being a flaw to being a mirror trait. Experiment number two is the village test. So Josie talked a lot about the importance of building a village of support instead of trying to solve everything by yourself. For this experiment, look at your support system and ask yourself, where do I currently get help with emotional support, with practical organization, accountability, creative encouragement, or other things that feel like they're missing? If a category is empty, that's your clue. So your experiment around that is to add just one form of new support, even if it's something small, like a body doubling session, an ADHD community, or a coaching conversation. Find out where the system is lacking, not the person. And number three, the unmasking micro moment. Masking is so often automatic, even when we don't realize we're doing it. For one day, notice moments when you feel the impulse to edit yourself in order to seem more, huge air quotes here, normal. Examples, stopping yourself from asking a question, or hiding your excitement or enthusiasm because you think it's going to come off as being too much. Or, this is a big one for me, pretending you understood instructions when you didn't, because maybe you were thinking about something else and a little bit distracted. Instead of forcing a big change, try one tiny experiment. Just let one small but authentic response happen, just once, and notice how it feels in your body. Because so often, the first step towards self-acceptance is just realizing how often we hide. That's your ADHD Alchemy Lab Kit for today. I hope you will pick one of these experiments and let me know how it goes. Thanks for listening to the ADHD Alchemy Podcast. If you're nodding along and thinking, oh yeah, that's me, then please subscribe and share this episode with another woman who gets it. Your reviews help more women discover they're not failing. They're just wired differently, and that is a good thing, despite the challenges. Plus, I want to hear your story. Apply to be a guest at myadhdalchemy.com and join my free community at fitology.com/community. Those links will be in the show notes. Together, we can rewrite the ADHD shame story into one of strength. I'll see you next time.